Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for being here tonight. I'm Alan Carey, Director of Sphere Education Initiatives. Excited to be hosting you for tonight's conversation about Race and the American Story, a fantastic new book that I'm eager for you all to learn more about. So many old friends joining us this evening. And for those of you who are new to the conversation tonight or haven't had a chance to join a Sphere webinar before, thank you all so much for coming. Sphere Education Initiatives works with middle and high school educators on things like free speech and civil discourse, and engaging in the kind of challenging conversations that bring people together from across ideological perspectives to talk about the most challenging issues confronting us here today. We'll tell you a little bit more about Sphere as we move into the conversation and as we talk about some of our resources tonight, but I'm excited to jump right into our conversation. We're joined by two incredible scholars to talk about their new book, Race and the American Story. I wanted to go ahead and introduce them now and then start right with the conversation. So joining us this evening is excuse me, Stephanie Shaunakin. She's a professor of ethnomusicology and dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland. Her doctorate in ethnomusicology and folklore is from Indiana University. Her heritage combines both West Africa and the Caribbean, allowing her to straddle the Black world comfortably. She has published articles and chapters on Fela Kuti, hip hop, soul, and country music. Her books include The Life of Camilla Williams, African American Classical Singer and Opera Diva, Soul, Country in the USA, Race and Identity in American Music Culture, and Black Lives Matter in Music, and Black Resistance in the Americas. Joining Stephanie tonight is Adam Seagrave, her co-author. He's the Associate Professor of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership at Arizona State University, where he teaches and writes about American political ideas. He has also held tenured positions in political science and constitutional democracy at the University of Missouri and Northern Illinois University. He's the author of The Accessible Federalist, Liberty and Equality, The American Conversation, and The Foundations of Natural Morality. From 2019 to 2021, he was on the leadership team at the Educating for American Democracy Project. He was awarded the 2021 American Legion National Education Award for his contributions to K-12 American civic education. Stephanie, Adam, thank you both so much for joining us for tonight's conversation. To share with the audience a little bit about what we can expect, we're going to begin the conversation tonight with Stephanie and Adam offering an overview and a presentation on their book. Then we'll dig into some conversation about key themes and ideas that are in there. And as always, for those of you joining us, please do put those questions that you have for Adam and Stephanie in the chat. We're looking forward to using those as the core component of our conversation going forward. Without further ado, Stephanie, Adam, let me turn it over to you. Tell us a little bit more about your incredible book, which I have right here, Race and the American Story.
Thank you so much, Alan. We are thrilled to be here with you all this evening. And so Adam and I want to give you a sense of how we came across this topic and how we came across this project. And we will talk a little bit about the book itself. We'll do a couple of quick readings, and then we look forward to a conversation in about 20 minutes or so. So please allow me to. I'm going to share my screen, and we'll run through this pretty quickly. But we wanted to at least give you a little bit of background on why and how we came to this topic. So, as Alan said, we have just published a new book called Race and the American Story. We are th really thrilled about this book. This is the first time, it's not the first time we've collaborated, but it's the culmination of our collaboration. And we look forward to doing even more after this. So the book is a result of something that happened when we both worked at the University of Missouri in 2015. In 2015, at the University of Missouri, I was chair of the Department of Black Studies, and Adam was a professor in political science and was also associate director of the Kinder Institute for Constitutional Democracy. When Adam arrived on campus, soon after this, I realized that he would be a really good affiliate for Black Studies, which is how we met. But just before Adam arrived, the students at the University of Missouri were still reeling and really troubled by what had happened on their campus for many, many years, but also what happened in St. Louis to Mike Brown. And so a lot of our students were students who lived and had grown up in St. Louis. St. Louis was only 2 hours away from our campus in Columbia, Missouri. And these students really wanted the university to help them understand what was going on. They also realized that what had happened to Mike Brown had happened to many other young Black people over the years. And they also felt that they shouldn't have to deal with that kind of living history, and they shouldn't have to also walk around on campus and be called the N-word almost every day. And so there were small events and big events that happened that led up to 2015. And finally, the students said, the University of Missouri needs to let all the students know that this kind of behavior will not be tolerated anymore. We cannot have a campus where some students don't feel as if it is home. The students who led the movement were students who actually really loved the University of Missouri and really wanted Mizzou to do better. It was dramatic. By the time all the dust had settled, there was a hunger strike. The football players said they wouldn't play, they wouldn't practice if the young man on the hunger strike wouldn't eat. And he said he wouldn't eat unless the president and the chancellor stepped down. When the president was asked what he understood by institutional racism, his answer was something like, "When you people don't think that you have access to things." And that to the entire community meant that this was a president who really didn't understand the history of racism in the country. By the time the football players stepped in, it's the SEC, so they don't play with football. And so the president and the chancellor did step down. As a result of that, in the aftermath of that movement, which actually spurred ripples across the country at different campuses everywhere, students were saying, we need to pause and think about what it means to be to be Black on these campuses. As a result of that, the University of Missouri asked me and a few of my colleagues to come up with a program to orient all incoming students to the campus. We didn't want to continue as normal. Our students had said they trusted us to come up with a program to orient students to just be good human beings when they come onto campus. They cannot come onto campus and call people horrible things. They cannot come onto campus and draw the swastika on the dorm walls, which had also happened around that same time. So we created this program called Citizenship at Mizzou. It was a program that all students had to go through. It was a 2-hour program. I'm an ethnomusicologist, so we used music to drive to really difficult conversations, and the conversations were driven by songs like Bob Dylan's "Blowin' in the Wind," where he's asking how many years will it take for us to see people as human beings, right? How many times will it take for us to hear what people are asking for? So "Blowing in the Wind," a Beatles song, a Queen Latifah song here and there, So we really chose songs that we felt could drive the conversations. And by and large, this was a very successful program. We spoke to thousands of students along the way. Evaluations of the program were great. A lot of students, most students said they were worried because remember, it's Missouri. So we had students from small rural towns, and we had students also from really large cities, none of whom really wanted to come to a mandatory program on DEI, right? But when they heard it was called Citizenship at Mizzou, like the concept of citizenship, right? And then when they also found out that their peers were playing music live on stage, they immediately let their guards down and came in, and we engaged in some really wonderful conversations. However, some students felt that it was too short, that 2 hours wasn't enough to really delve into the history of race and racism in this country. Enter Adam Segrave. And so we were grappling with what to do ab about this limitation of time. And so Adam came to me with an idea.
Yeah, so as Stephanie said, I arrived at the University of Missouri just after the year after all of these events had happened, and Stephanie had built this orientation program. And my idea was to extend the Citizenship at Mizzou program over the course of a semester into a 3-credit course that would combine the musical culture component that was a huge part of the program with history and politics in America, and combine those two things to give students a broader perspective and understanding of the history of and culture of race in America. So these are the learning objectives that Stephanie and I and a group of other faculty that we convened came up with. And I want to highlight particularly the second and third bullet points there. This idea of connecting historical documents and ideas and also cultural history and musical history to contemporary discourse in the United States and to current events, we thought that was really important because that would give students some understanding of why we were where we were in that moment, and why there were these very difficult things going on around us, why our community was so divided, and there's a long history to all of that, and we sit on top of a huge iceberg of history and of culture that has brought us to where we are today. So we wanted to build a course that would do that, and that would bring students together who might not otherwise be in the same classroom, and so we developed this syllabus. And again, Stephanie and I, in conjunction with other faculty members in Black Studies and also in the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy, and these are readings from white Americans and Black Americans, from men and women, and so it's a a depiction of history from the people who lived it and made it and produced these profound reflections on the history of race in America. And the ones that are highlighted there are women authors who were originally absent from my own African American political thought syllabus. That relates to something I'll talk about in a minute, which is what I call my colorblind spot, but not in this case with respect to gender as well. It's embarrassing for me looking back on it, but I didn't have any women authors in my original syllabus. So, and Stephanie will talk about the next parts, next step in our collaboration.
And so we developed the course, taught it. The first time we taught it to, we didn't know what the enrollment would look like. We just had an idea that some students wanted more than the 2 hours. And we shared, we had 5 sections with 20 seats in each section, and we asked 3 of our colleagues to take a section each. And then we each took us a section, and all the sections were full. And so we knew we were onto something. So we taught this for a year or two at Mizzou, and then in 2018, Adam and I left. We both left Mizzou at the same time, and he went to Arizona State University. I went to the University of Massachusetts, and we decided that we would continue teaching it. And so we kept teaching it at our new places. Our colleagues at Mizzou kept teaching it at Mizzou. And we realized, oh, this is becoming a bigger thing. We decided then that we would bring all the students together to a symposium where we could bring students from Massachusetts and students from Arizona State and students from Mizzou to one place to talk about all these readings and to share what they were learning. And what we realized was that perspectives are always so different. So it was interesting to bring a very kids from a very blue state and students from a purplish, reddish state to all together to discuss these readings. And what we did was that we wanted to model for the students what it looks like to collaborate from different fields, which is definitely Adam and myself, and also from different backgrounds. We are very different. And so when we decided to think about writing this book, we wanted to bring ourselves to it. We wanted to show that this was a journey, and that if we could take this journey, that anybody could make that effort to and take the journey. As you can tell from my accent, I'm not from here. I'm half Nigerian, half Trinidadian, although I am Black, and so that was a journey. And then Adam as well has had his own story and his own journey to understanding race in America. So at this point, we're going to read a little piece from the book. I'll read a piece. I think I'm not sure who reads first. I read first. Okay, so I'm going to read a little piece from the book just to show you how the book is a weaving of our personal stories with the theory, with the culture, with the history. And we think that if we all can realize who we are and understand our positionality in terms of race in America, we will be much more honest and much more willing to make the journey. So I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs from the beginning where I talk about myself. So it's somewhere on page 12. Everybody go buy the book. It's on Amazon. I didn't know I was Black until I came to the United States. The journey to my personal understanding of Blackness has been long and rife with pain and passion, excitement and exasperation. The fact that the facets of my identity seem to stretch across the diaspora, Equatorial Guinea, Nigeria, Trinidad and Tobago, and the United States, means that this journey has not been straightforward. It has been treacherous, with many frustrating moments when I was not sure how much lower my self-esteem could go. But it has also been exceedingly rewarding as I stumbled upon new paths to convert each disappointment into an opportunity to grow and become more confident in who I was. Sometimes that has meant becoming overzealous in my own self-affirmation, the tone of my voice taking on a sharper edge, as I explained to others why pride in Blackness was a requisite characteristic of any kind of Black progress. But I justify that stridence by thinking of the dearth of encouragement from sources that are not bothered by the profundity of Blackness, including the educational system, popular culture, and mainstream media. And so I'm thinking of time, so I'm not going to read much more, but a few pages on, I talk about how when we arrived in the United States, the week after we arrived, someone called out to my husband and myself and called him the N-word. So I'm going to turn it now to Adam to just share a little of his own personal story, and then we'll move through quickly.
So I'll read from the beginning of kind of my background, which contrasts, as you'll see, with very much with Stephanie's that she just read. I grew up in a very white world. I got into Stanford simply by birth, and by that I mean I was born in the Stanford University Hospital, and then moved to Napa, California from the South Bay Area when I was 8. During the first years of my life, we lived in nice-sounding places like Sunnyvale and Mountain View. Having begun life at a prestigious university, I spent my childhood in sunny vales with views of mountains before transitioning to vineyards and wineries. We had moved to Napa primarily for the sake of a very small private Catholic school there, which I attended through 8th grade. Clearly, I was privileged. I can count on one hand the number of people I knew throughout my childhood who might be identified as Black. I had no racist feelings or tendencies whatsoever. I couldn't really, because I didn't have any feelings or thoughts about non-white people at all. I didn't care either way, and I didn't know any better. I was, in a way, colorblind because I literally never saw anyone of a different color, or if I did, I merely saw them without seeing them. My color blindness, though, was a moral blindness. And so, reflecting on that idea of what I call a colorblind spot, I was thinking about how this connects with American history and with how we tell American history, and also with the Constitution itself. I think many of whose authors also suffered from this colorblind spot, this kind of moral blindness that we sometimes call color blindness. So, want to just quickly talk about a couple of narratives of American history that I bring out and that we talk about in the book and connect with Stephanie's analysis of music and musical culture. So the Mount Rushmore narrative of history, this is this great men narrative that, and normally those great men who made American history are white men. And as we see on Mount Rushmore there, for example. And this narrative of history has been predominant throughout most of American history until fairly recently. And it overlooks many important stories of people and their contributions and their experiences that don't fit into or don't make it into this sort of great man Mount Rushmore depiction of American history. So in recent years, in the last few decades, there have been other narratives of American history that have emerged to correct the Mount Rushmore history. And these are very welcome narratives. I call them the untold story narratives. And this idea is that we need to bring to light contributions to American history and culture by people who are left out of the Mount Rushmore great man narrative. Particularly non-white people, people of color, Black Americans who have contributed to American history and culture in such profound and important ways that had been overlooked before. So these two narratives, I think, complement each other in different ways, and they're both incomplete in some ways. So I then talk about the human freedom narrative of American history, which I think combines both the some aspects of the Mount Rushmore narrative with some aspects of the untold story narrative, and showing how the idea of freedom or liberty has in American history united both white and Black Americans in understanding what's important about being an American, or what identifies us as Americans is this commitment to freedom. And so, as examples of that, here there's this petition by a free African American in Massachusetts named Prince Hall in 1777, in which he argues that the Declaration of Independence essentially requires that slavery be abolished, and petitions Massachusetts, the legislature, to do this, referring to the right to freedom there. And then also the performance of Lift Every Voice and Sing at the Super Bowl there by Andra Day just this past year, and the reference to liberty as a theme of that song, and of many aspects of African American culture, this struggle for freedom in the United States. And that theme also connects with many of the musical cultural elements of American history. And so I'll turn it back to Stephanie to talk about that aspect of our book.
Sure. Thank you, Adam. And so we do a lot with the history and the political science analysis of that history using mostly primary documents. In fact, all our documents are in the course, and that we talk about our primary source. And then we always in the class ask our students to think about music as well, you know, and they have a lot of fun thinking about music, the music that also tells the story of America, of race in America. And so these are just two excerpts. There's no time I've taught this class that there's no mention of these two songs. One, of course, by Childish Gambino, This Is America, and of course, Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit, which I've found to be so generative, this Strange Fruit song, particularly now as we think about the what's happening around the world. Because as I remind students, this song was written by a Jewish teacher, but it was about black bodies that were lynched. So it's a beautiful song, but also really, really painful. And so the students link the what they know of these songs with the readings that they've encountered. So Strange Fruit is always matched with Ida B. Wells and what she's written, what she had written about lynchings in the South. And then I also spend time on really sharing with them music that they may not have encountered, and I'm not going to play because we don't have time, but this album, if you all have a paper and pencil, please write this down. Max Roach, jazz drummer in 1960, he produced an incredible album called We Insist, Max Roach's Freedom Suite. It is, to me, one of the most important musical texts of the 20th century. And in that album, it's just five tracks. He goes through from slavery to emancipation to the Jim Crow era, and then he steps o over to Africa and talks about what's happening with apartheid in South Africa. Again, five tracks, mind-blowing. So please listen to it when you get a chance. And this is a video of Max Roach and Abby Lincoln and the band doing the album in Europe in the 1960s. No time. Okay, and so we'll end now and really open it up for questions. But we want to end with W.E.B. Du Bois, who's really woven through many parts of the book, and we talk about him in the class. When I first came across W.E.B. Du Bois' Credo, I was so moved, because we should all have a credo. We should all have a set of values, a set of beliefs that we believe that we hold to and that we stand on. And I think that Du Bois' credo is so powerful. He has about seven things. It's eight things, I'm sorry. And each belief is something worth thinking about. Number two, I believe in pride of race and lineage and self, in pride of self so deep as to scorn injustice to other selves. I think this is so powerful. In number, there's one where, of course, here I'm just putting up some small excerpts, but in it he also says that he believes in the right to breathe and the right to be free. And if he had known in 1904 when he wrote that concept, that notion of just breathing, you know, let me breathe, I cannot breathe, that so much time has passed by, and yet we're still fighting for that right. So it's so powerful. It's something that I do in class, to ask students to think about writing their own credo. So on that note, Alan, we will stop there. We're thrilled to be with you all. I'll stop sharing, and we look forward to a conversation. Thank you.
Stephanie, Adam, thank you both so much for sharing that with us. There's so much incredible material in the book that I know we didn't get a chance to get to yet. I have just a couple of questions. I'm going to turn directly to the ones from the audience, because we've got some really fantastic ones coming in. Stephanie, I wanted to dig in a little bit more to something that you talked about that really is the core of your academic work, and that's thinking about the role of music in education. And I think the unique way in which you both were able to use music as a cultural artifact and bringing that into that understanding, but there's a teaching of these kinds of ideas and principles, but helping people see each other through the lens of understanding the music that brings them together. Tell us a little bit about that for many teachers here who may not yet have had the opportunity or have thought to use music as a mechanism for shaping some of what it is that they teach. How do you go about doing that? How do you select for it in ways that lead to productive conversations? And what are some tips you can give to our teachers on how to do that well?
That's great. Thank you, Alan. So I believe that most people like music, and it's just a really great way to lead into some really difficult conversations. The fact is that African American music, which is what I study, I study Black music, and write about it. I also study American popular music and think that country music is also such a rich place to think about American history. That American music, American popular music, is a wonderful chronicler of American history, and that indeed we can do a whole history class just with music. If we are looking specifically at Black music, we could go from the spirituals all the way to hip hop, from a song like "Wade in the Water," where we're talking about how slaves were, or the enslaved were, escaping their plantations, right? To and going through water to throw off the scent that the dogs might pick up. So wading in the water had double meaning, from a spiritual like that all the way to a song by Kendrick Lamar called "All Right," where he's saying we gonna be all right. But that song is connected to the wade in the water. So in terms of picking those songs, students know songs too. They can, and we think that popular music is not useful. It's not deep, but it's extremely deep. I mean, taking soul music, gospel music, as I said, country music, we can learn so much from just using music. And just if we want to just stay on the lyrics, just stay on the lyrics. The album I talked about will also ask you to think sonically about what is happening with the dynamics of the drums and so on, and what message are the musicians trying to send us when they make certain choices with the instruments.
That's incredible. I love that idea. And I think something that's come up a couple of times in the chat here, but also in some other sessions and conversations we've had, is thinking about how to engage in challenging conversations with students, particularly in, we'll call it, challenging political climates, where there have been some conversations about limiting what can be taught and to whom and when, thinking about the role that music can play and still getting at those important conversations, even in those kinds of moments. Thinking about music as a primary source in that sense can be a really incredible way of doing that. Thank you for sharing that. Adam, I wanted to dig into something that you talk about in the book that we didn't quite get to in the conversation so far. And I think it's a really interesting point that is difficult for a lot of educators. And so you talk about the idea of thinking about institutional racism. And thinking about things like white privilege and some of the ways in which you would argue the Constitution, in many ways, is an example of institutionalized racism, but in a way that people may not necessarily have come to think about it previously. I wonder if you might share a little bit about the argument that you make in the book when thinking about those sort of challenging ideas, where they're right and important, but also ways in which they may be challenging and misleading. And Stephanie, please jump in on this one as well.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Alan. So with respect to institutional racism or institutionalized racism and or what you might call systemic racism as well, with respect to the Constitution, I think that the way I treat that in the book, I do think adds some nuance to the conversation, as you said. And so on the one hand, I certainly admit in the analysis of the Constitution that it is a racist document in the sense that the people who wrote it suffered from the kinds of moral blindness with respect to Black Americans that I say I suffered from as well in my childhood, but they disregarded and downplayed and neglected the claims of justice and of natural rights of African Americans, and supported slavery in various ways through the Constitution, not you know again not directly but indirectly in all kinds of ways. So, and I think that the Constitution it strengthened a society that was racist, and it supported states where where slavery was legal and supported them and strengthened them in various ways. So the Constitution indirectly supported slavery and racism in all kinds of ways. But I also don't think that I think it's an oversimplification to say that the Constitution is racist. And I think that's because there's a kind of spectrum of racism and ways in which racism applies differently to different entities. Like a person can be racist in ways that a document like the Constitution can't. So I think we should qualify the way in which we label documents like the Constitution racist and distinguish it from the way in which people can be and are racist, because those aren't the same thing.
Stephanie, anything you would add?
Well, I would just add that words are really important, right? And we know, for example, the concept of white privilege is a concept. It's real. It's true, right? But I found at Mizzou, when I first created citizenship at Mizzou, that as we were thinking of a training program, we knew that if we had a program that talked about white privilege, that so many of our students, our incoming students, their parents would just be turned off. Like they hadn't had time to understand this history. And there's so many connotations to things like white privilege, to things like diversity, to those words now have so much baggage in this culture. So to get through it, we realized that we should just think about what we call things. And so I remember when we first started citizenship at Mizzou, we called it diversity at Mizzou, and students were not having it. I remember I was in my office when a student came with his parent, and they were both in fatigues, and they were like, "What is this program?" And then another student came to me and said, "Dr. Shanika, why don't we just change the name of the program to citizenship at Mizzou? Because that word diversity, we understand what you're trying to do, but it will turn off half of the students that come here." So, right or wrong, I wanted to reach as many students as possible. So we did that, and I think we do grapple it in the book a lot at in some of the sections that Adam writes, with these concepts, these words. How do we What is the connotation, and how can we think about them more clearly?
I wanted to turn next to some of the questions that are coming in from the teachers joining us tonight. Some of these are really tough, and I'm glad you guys get to be the ones answering them and not me. But some of them, I think I want to start off with an important one. One of the teachers asks, thinking about this book, would it be something appropriate for a high school audience? So, as high school teachers, many of them, some of them middle school teachers, to what extent would you recommend using something like this book, or if not the book in particular, the underlying approach described in the book as a mechanism for working in some of these kinds of classrooms?
I highly recommend it. I think we were so careful and attentive to freshmen, like undergraduate students who are just coming on campus. We wanted them to really pick this book up and think for themselves. This is very much a book that asks our readers to just contend with these concepts, these documents, and then think for themselves. And so the book is, we think, very accessible. It's published by Oxford University Press. Both of us have our voices really enmeshed in through this, and I do think a high school class can pick this book up, and the students could definitely navigate through it and pull something from it, especially because we bring ourselves to it as well. You meet a young Stephanie with her doll that doesn't look like her. And I tell that story about what it's like to be a black girl with a white doll growing up across the Atlantic. I think high school students would also have those stories and those understandings. And Adam does the exact same thing. So I recommend it.
Adam, I actually want to pose this next question to you. It's from of our alumni, Kevin Wagner. He teaches in Pennsylvania. He asks, as a high school piloting the new AP African American Studies course, many of our Black students feel that as a white teacher, we have no credibility to teach Black history. This has come from many of our Black students in our Black Student Union. With your understanding from teaching a collaborative course in Missouri, how can we help our students realize that all of us are on a journey of understanding and the missing understanding the missing pieces of our history? So how have you approached these kinds of situations, and what would advice would the two of you give for an educator in a similar situation?
Yeah, thanks, Kevin, for that question. That's great and really important. So, I think that one aspect of an answer, as I think you said, Alan, is getting students to realize that Black history and Black American history is American history, and it's part of the American story, right? That we all have some part in, and in which we all belong, right? That we all belong as part of this story with our different backgrounds. And so I think that's a big part of it. But then on the other hand as well, balancing that approach, that inclusive approach, with an awareness that as a white teacher of this topic, one certainly needs to be extremely aware of and sensitive to, and has to listen very carefully to their Black students and their students of color who have different experiences and backgrounds than they do. And so I've learned a lot from Black students in my courses and just students who are unlike me in various ways. And I think it's very important as a white teacher of these topics, and in my case, to a white male teacher, to really show your students that you care about them and listen to them, and make sure they know their experiences and stories are valuable contributions to the class as a whole. So I think that's important. And then also emphasizing that we are part of one community. We share a history in the United States, and that's a history, and these are causes of justice that all of us, white and black and of every ethnic racial background, all of us should be concerned with and should care about.
And then, can I add really quickly, Alan?
Please do.
And also a recognition that it's uncomfortable. It is definitely uncomfortable, and understanding that many of our Black students have been in the uncomfortable position in other classes, right? That they are sometimes the only student in a particular class. And so that discomfort in the classroom is something that we all go through. And a lot of it is about building trust. And so I remember when Adam and I both taught Race and the American Story, guess what? His class was all white and my class was all black. And so we realized it is what it is. It is a reflection of this country, you know. And so what we did was we said, okay, what can we do? So we decided that we would host these dinners, and all of our students would come together and see each other and break bread and so on. And with time, I think in the following semester, he got some Black students, and I got some white students, and so it evolved. But it doesn't start and go well at the beginning. It's building trust, understanding, as Adam said, that these students have a right to feel uncomfortable given this really difficult history. But we as teachers, I always say, I wasn't born here, I'm not African American, but I'm doing the work, I'm learning, I'm growing, and once students in my experience, once they see your heart, they cut you a little slack.
I think that's such a critically important point that the two of you bring up is thinking about it is challenging at first. It takes some work to go through it, but the benefit of engaging in these conversations is so much greater than the safety of avoiding these kinds of conversations. So encouraging educators to take that leap is I think a particularly important part of the work that you all are doing here. I wanted to pose another challenging question that came in that I think is a good one, and it comes at this from a slightly different angle than some of what we talked about before. So Steve asks, or he says, my middle school of about 1,000 is a diverse population in a community that is surrounded by mostly very homogeneous towns. Recently, we have added several clubs, including a Black Student Alliance, a Muslim club, and a Jewish Heritage Club. And while I'm glad to have these clubs, I'm concerned of creating in more of a silo-like environment. So he asks, I welcome your thoughts on how to foster more harmony among my school community while acknowledging, on the one hand, the interest in some groups spending time together, what often referred to as affinity groupings, but also conscious of the concern of what happens when you separate people out and the risk of not engaging across our differences. I'm paraphrasing a little of what's implied in some of Steve's question there. But Stephanie, let me pose this one to you. And thinking about some of the things like you were just talking about, where you had one class that showed up for you and Adam had a different one that showed up with him at first, how do you think about the benefit and challenges of something like affinity groups and some of the way to create harmony in a kind of educational setting?
I believe in affinity groups. I think they're great. I think it's important for students to get together and feel re and let their hair down and feel comfortable. And so I do believe strongly in affinity groups. That said, I think this is a really important question. How do you get the students to come out from the affinity groups and feel comfortable learning from each other in spaces where they're blended? I think that takes effort as well. I think for Adam and myself, we have tried to model for our students what we want them to also do. You know, I've got at Mizzou, I had some sort of diehard Black Power students, you know, and when they saw me working with Adam, they were like, they were curious, you know, and we're working on race. They were curious and they were watching and they saw that we didn't, you know, let go of who we were. You know, I was still this Black woman and Adam was still this white man, and we were able to work together to create this project. So, in terms of a quick answer to the question, modeling for students what allyship looks like, and what collaboration looks like is critical. And that is something that will follow them through university into life. And then creating spaces and opportunities for them to work together. That takes planning carefully, to try and get them all to work on a project or something. And with time, they get to know each other. And I always say if we could study like a jazz band, you know, how a jazz ensemble is created. We could learn a lot about listening to each other, being attentive, getting the egos to come down, and to create something really beautiful.
Adam, what would you add?
Yeah, no, I love what Stephanie just said about the jazz band and the metaphor, and I think she said it really well. Yeah, I think that there's where we come from as individuals, and then there's where we meet with other people, and I think that things like affinity groups are very important for cultivating that sense of self connected to our ancestral cultural backgrounds, and with other people who share that background. But then I think it's also important to meet with other students from other backgrounds in some space, right? And collaborate, as Stephanie said. as well. And I think that that actually enriches the collaboration and the way we work together if we do have a strong sense of self and our own background and what we bring to each other and to these collaborations. And yeah, the importance of listening. I think that's such an important human trait that we can really cultivate by reaching out to people across different groups, however you define those groups in terms of race or ethnicity or religion. So yeah, so I think that it's important to have both. I think you need to have a cultivation of particular backgrounds that are not shared by all students in a community, but then you also have to have spaces where students come together and where collaboration is valued and is explored.
So, interesting comment that came in the chat. It was more of a quotation of sorts of the kind of thing that many of our teachers are hearing from their students. So, this particular, we had several of them pop up, but I think this one's interesting. Judith mentions that one of her eighth graders had said, "How can we explain white privilege when so many Black people are successful in America?" So, one of the kinds of confusions and frustrations that often manifest is we see some progress, but we also see tremendous setbacks. And how do we help our students see the fullness of the current situation in a way that appreciates the complexity of the situation we're in? I think that's in many ways, as I read your book, the beauty of the whole approach is that it is clear-eyed about engaging the question of race in the American story. And the good and the bad and the rough things that have come along with it, and not simply looking at a narrative of, well, things are great now, because in many ways they're still very complicated. So to boil that down to what I hope is a relatively straightforward question, how do you think about helping students understand that complexity, right? Especially the younger they are when they're coming to grapple with these things, maybe in a way that they've never thought about before. How might they do that in a way that is productive, but also respectful of what's a challenging conversation to have?
Adam, you should take this because you write about this beautifully in the book.
Thanks. Yeah, no, well, and of course you'll add to what I have to say too, but yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that so the key point there, and talking about the concept of white privilege, particularly, or institutional racism, as we talked about before, the key thing is that nothing is simple. Right, nothing is simple in American history, in American society, of course, and human beings also are not simple. Human beings are complex beings, and so I think often the mistakes we make when we talk about these concepts and issues around race in current society or in American history is that we oversimplify them, and I think that one way of combating that and of adding some nuance and helping students to see that complexity is by introducing them to the kinds of primary texts that we have introduced into our classes and that we would suggest introducing in K-12 classrooms as well. You know, both musical texts and primary historical documents and texts, and just exposing students to events and people and music and art in history that disrupt the simplified narratives that they hear from either from classmates or from their culture generally. Because I think that that's generally what these primary documents do. I think they disrupt our oversimplified narratives. And so that's what I'd suggest. Not even engaging necessarily directly with these concepts that are and these buzzwords that are thrown around all the time, but first introducing students to the complexifying, if I can coin a term, the complexifying history and historical primary sources. I think that is a good approach in my view.
And then I'll just add very quickly, Judith's question is one that I've heard many times, and it's fair. It's a fair question because when people, don't have a lot of money, they just, how can you say that I'm privileged? And so it's a fair one. And I heard this a lot in 2015 when the students were talking a lot about white privilege and institutional racism. And my neighbors, I lived next to some wonderful neighbors in Colombia. All of them were white, and they couldn't understand what the students were talking about because they kept saying, "Look, slavery has been over. What are these students talking about?" And I finally said, "Look, if you can't, I know that you're not black, but you cannot tell a black person how to think about what they're going through." And I struggled with how to explain this. And I finally came up with a one, which I think is a wonderful analogy, which I write about in the book. And it's basically, I thought about, when do I have some privilege in my skin over white people? And in my view, it's because I don't have to wear sunscreen. I don't wear it, and so for all the years I grew up near the equator where it was very, very hot, I never wore sunscreen. But Alan, I know you cannot go out without sunscreen, just looking at you, right? And so in that way, I have some privilege over you. Now, am I going to go to Walgreens and tell them to clear the shelf of SPF? That's not going to help you. It's going to hurt you. And so I don't know what you go, all the red blobs and so on, but I've never had that. So that's a way that I could explain what white privilege means when you're walking into a store as a white person and don't get followed. I may have more in my purse than you do, but they'll still follow me just because of my skin color. And so the SPF WTF is the name of my TED Talk. It's a real TED Talk. Go check it out. SPF WTF. It's a great way to really think about what privilege means when the shoe is on the other foot.
It's a fantastic example, and I do appreciate you not asking them to remove sunscreen. Well, I may not need it as badly as some. That would be a really rough day at the beach
That's
otherwise.
right. That's right.
We have just a couple of minutes left before we're going to transition to talking a little bit about some Sphere content and resources to support some of the educators who are joining us tonight. So I wanted to ask Adam, Stephanie, if you had some concluding thoughts that you wanted to share. And I think particularly thinking about middle school and high school educators who are here tonight or maybe watching this recording, if they wanted to get started, if they wanted to say, okay, I wanted to take some initial steps with my students to begin to engage in the kind of work that you all have done and have modeled through both your coursework, your book, and your continuing conversations, what advice would you have to them? How can they begin to do what it is that you've done? And would love to hear each of you on how you might encourage them to do that.
Thanks, Alan. So I guess I would say, first of all, I think read our book. I think that's a, it could be a good introduction to yeah, to just how Stephanie and I have approached our collaboration and how that could help in various classrooms and school communities. And I think also just it's so important to to look for people who aren't like you in various ways, or who might disagree with you, or who have different background than you do in your school community, both students and administrators and faculty, and think about what they might teach you, how you might learn from them, how you could work with them and collaborate with them. I think that's something it's very difficult to do. It's not something that's comfortable for most people, but I think just the good that can come from that, I think, is just tremendous, and I think Stephanie's and my collaboration is evidence of that.
And I'll just say also to that what we came up with at Mizzou was unique to Mizzou. It could not have worked at the University of Nebraska or University of Michigan. It was specific to Mizzou. Citizenship at Mizzou was very much a Mizzou thing. And I say that because I think where you start is where you are. There were a lot of people who thought that Mizzou should just go buy an online training tool, and that will fix all of it. And we realized that, we needed an in-person event where every student would sit with us and just see who's in the room and realize that, oh, there are people here from really tiny towns and big cities, and how would we expect that we would all get along without some effort? So I'll just say, start with the middle school. Where's the middle school? What are the demographics? How can you work on it? And then I'll just throw in also, because I have to, that even taking something fun like the new Beyoncé country album, right, could be generative, right? It could be so amazing because the students are thinking about this, talking about this. How could you use that as a way of thinking about race and popular culture? The fact that country stations won't play her music. What does that mean? What are the boundaries of country music? Who gets to play it? And then you can go to the Tracy Chapman song and have an amazing time with that. So make it fun, even though it's really these are really hard conversations.
Adam, Stephanie, thank you both so much for taking the time to join us tonight to share the work that you've done, your book, and to answer the many questions we have here. Really greatly appreciated having had the opportunity to hear and learn from you, and looking forward to encouraging so many people to read the book. It's incredible. As they both mentioned, pick up the book, take a read. It's both affordable in paperback. I'll note the hardcover is save that for your university libraries. But it's a wonderful book. Please do read it. And again, Adam, Stephanie, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.